Bienvenidos, and welcome to the next installment of Lead Media Programming from Studio 54, campus of California State University, San Bernardino, the digital media platform for inspired educators, leaders, and community activists and advocates, taking our message directly to the people, to the gente. Thank you for sharing our common interests in the analysis, discussion, critique, dissemination, and commitment to the educational issues that impact Latinos. I'm your host, Dr. Enrique Murillo Jr., and this episode is a syndicated replay from Season 3 of LEAD Summit 2012. Colleges and universities designated as Hispanic-serving institutions, HSI, with at least 25% of the students identifying as Hispanic, are poised to rigorously address complex and multifaceted social issues as they apply to the growing demographic. However, at the time, while the HSI designation played a significant role in the historical trajectory of Latino education in the U.S., educators and policymakers were troubled by the dismal success rate of this ethnographic populace in education, ranging from disproportionate high school push-out rates through low college graduation rates and even into the professoriate, with less than 4% of doctoral degrees being awarded to Hispanics. The practice of privileging HSI-designated colleges and universities with additional competitive grant funding had begged the question, how do these practices serve Latinos in and out of higher education institutions? The HSI designation was created to compensate for existing educational disparities and recognize the educational achievement gaps of Hispanics. Educational inequality was a legacy of unfair practices such as unequal educational funding, unfair housing practices, and employment discrimination. The HSI designation is a call to action. It is not exclusively summoning Latinos. It is a notice to higher education institutions. HSI should bear a message and a mandate, a directive of inclusivity, of collectivity, of integration, representation, and accountability. Continue and enjoy the full value and complexity of this episode. We extend our appreciation to all our LEAD sponsors and partners, planners, volunteers, speakers and panelists, production team, affiliates, and town hall chapters, and commend them all for lifting their voice and uplifting the plight of Latinos in education. Thank you. Gracias. Tlazo Camate.
My name is Stephen Villasenor. I'm the director for Upward Bound here at Cal State San Bernardino. Of course, Upward Bound is dedicated to getting low-income first-generation students graduated from high school and into college. And as Assistant Secretary for Post-Secondary Education mentioned, Dr. Ochoa, is an integral part of closing the educational gap that we have today. My job is to introduce the panel, and without further ado, Daniel Lorea is the Multicultural Affairs Director at the University of Laverne. He is the moderator for the panel. Dr. Herman Garcia is a regent professor in the College of Education at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. Deborah Santiago is the Vice President for Policy and Research for Excelencia in Education. Eric Romero is the Executive Director of Western State Legislative Affairs for HACU. And Dr. Rodolfo Chavez is the Regents Professor in the College of Education at New Mexico State University. I'd like to now pass it over to Daniel Lorea, who will explain the format and a little more about the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Just a couple of quick items here. I have my force with me, which also tells me the time. This is going to be my timekeeper. We're going to give individuals 7 minutes initially to sort of present some of the subject matter that we're discussing this afternoon. And just to kind of give you an idea, we're going to shift a little bit from the programmatic initiative and focus that we've had earlier to a little bit more academic presentation this afternoon. So we need you to breathe in some fresh air and hold tight. I think it's going to be a real timely presentation. This conversation that we're sort of focusing on has been something that's been going on since the inception of this designated topic of Hispanic serving institution. just 2 years, or actually about 4 years ago in Southern California, there were, I think, about 45 designated Hispanic-serving institutions. Then a couple years later, I don't know what happened, suddenly there were like 63 of them. This is absolutely, there's immense growth taking place, and people are trying to figure out what does it mean. So I think the subject matter today that we're discussing, Hispanic-serving institution, cultural citizenship, challenges for transformation. This is an ongoing conversation. I think that we're going to get bits of what folks are thinking and what should be part of the process of thinking. And it's not just us, but I think it needs to be all of us that in the end are a part of this conversation. So without further ado, let me, if I may, invite our first panelist, Dr. Rodolfo Chavez Chavez.
Buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes.
HSI Cultural Citizenship, Challenges for Transformation. This title came from the brain power work of the HSI Working Group. We are located in Las Cruces, New Mexico. All of us except one are professors in New Mexico State University. However, we're independent of New Mexico State University. The HSI Working Group is made up out of 9 or 10 individuals. Let me name them. They're very important because they're a part of this special issue journal. Dana Green, Antonio Lara, Dulcinea Lara, Carlos Posadas, Cristina Medina, Heather Astrike, Marisol Ruiz, Michelle Valverde, and Herman Garcia, and of course myself, who are the co-editors of this special issue. It is a working group, it's interdisciplinary and intercollegiate. And we noticed several contradictions. We were created about 3 or 4 years ago, and because of those contradictions about the notion of HSI, we decided to begin researching it and learning more about it. To begin, notwithstanding the fine examples of and about Latinos and Latinas' success today, as it was shown by many of the Puente Plebe that's here, wonderful, wonderful, and your centeredness and so on that you have, and how you are looking at the notion of learning and the notion of success. Notwithstanding, higher education in general, except for small pockets, is a mass of social dementia, where they cloak themselves in fine garments of historical amnesia, embroidered with myth, half-truths, and majoritarian superiority. Hispanic-serving institutions are, in the grand scheme, no more than a bleep on the historical timeline of higher education. Within this bleep, a body of literature has materialized that chronicles the importance, as well as the indifference to what the designation implicates. The material qualities of the HSI designation as a phenomenon are by no means amusing. It is a serious enterprise that interrogates eraser and invisibility, challenges the master narratives that patronize and creatively exclude, and in turn creates a collective struggle for equity and social justice. It is a collective citizenship, a democratic citizenship, that has organically materialized into what Renato Rosaldo coined as our Chicano cultural citizenship. It is the entire cultural citizenry, the we, immersed in the construction of an HSI reality, who are the HSI cultural citizens that must propel the idea onto its own next revolutionary level of transformation. HSI, as a phenomenon, does not pick and choose its constituents. We are in it together. There is no litmus test. The HSI designation encompasses many markers: ideological, logistical, procedural, visible, concealed, marked, and unmarked, that privilege the success of particular white and middle or upper class students and impede the success of others, namely students of color and poor students, demarcations shamefully intertwined into the socio-educational fabric of the United States. And let me mention where I got some of these ideas. I got them from Green and Astrike, from Lara and Lara, Ruiz and Valverde, and Santiago, who is here with us today. And these are all public articles within the special issue. Enter the making of HSI, politics. Politics is neither a science nor art, but rather a play for power and a game for position of power. The notion of politics not by any means an amusing game, but rather a deadly serious game that entails a full range of human emotion. Those that are subordinated by its rules and regulations are not only those who wish to play politics and struggle for power, but also those who merely observe or stand on the sidelines and turn their back on politics. Indifference to politics has of yet never guaranteed anyone immunity for its consequences. Not to the surprise of any, but to poignantly identify its beginnings, Santiago names the HSI phenomenon what it is: a political construct. The rapid and steady growth of the Latino population in the United States, paired with the demographics current and historical legacy of struggle in the US context, has resulted in myriad challenging social issues. As current local, state, and national political conversations focus on issues that bring Latinas and Latinos to center stage, including immigration, high rates of unemployment, healthcare, poverty, disproportionate incarceration, and inequitable access to education. Higher education can become the vantage point from which many of these social questions may find possible solutions. More specifically, colleges and universities designated HSIs are poised to address the complex issues as they apply to the growing demographics of Latinos and Latinas. Students and faculty at HSI-designated institutions who have been leading and with increased support continue to engage in the struggle for cognitive justice. Dr. Garcia will be talking about that in a little while, Herman. These are frontline struggles to increase Latino student success. HSIs can and should be at the forefront of systemic paradigmatic shifts that address social inequalities and therefore move us forward toward meaningful and sustainable social transformation. And while the number of colleges and universities with this designation is rapidly growing, HSIs currently comprise only about 5%, listen to this, 5% of the higher education institutions in the US, while serving almost 50% of Latino college population. While the HSI designation plays a significant role in the historical trajectory of Hispanic education in the US, educators and policymakers are troubled by the dismal success rate of the ethnographic populace in education. The practice of privileging HSI-designated colleges and universities with additional competitive grant funding begs the question: how do these practices serve Hispanics in and out of higher education institutions? Examples of how resources are used include faculty development, funds and administrative management, development and improvement of academic programs, endowment funds, curriculum development, scientific and laboratory equipment for teaching, renovation of instructional facilities, joint use of facilities, academic tutoring, counseling programs, and student support services. In conclusion, the HSI phenomenon as a designation was created to compensate for existing educational disparities and to recognize the educational achievement of Hispanics. The HSI designation must be problematized as a phenomenon by reauthoring how we labor within the higher within the institutions of higher education and ideologically name, or that is codify, and value, that is commodify, the curriculum and enterprise of teaching and learning. Thank you.
Telephone. You know, it's funny that, how many of you are here for the previous panel? Okay, good, everyone here. Thank you for being the hardworking people who have stayed. So they kind of refer to that previous panel as the geek panel. So I think we're affectionately should be referred to as the nerd panel. Since our take is a little bit more academic. So my perspective is a little bit based on policy and the work that I do at the organization that I helped co-found, Excelencia in Education. So let me just take a little bit of a step back from the powerful comments that my colleague made and make sure that we make no assumptions about what we're talking about here. First, I guess the question would be, what are Hispanic-serving institutions? And, you know, I often in a room and I start talking and realize that we don't have a common definition or there isn't a clear understanding. So let me start with that and go into some of the questions and thoughts that I have about Hispanic serving institutions. And I should say, I had the very good fortune of being in the U.S. Department of Education in 1994, and where HSIs were first funded at the federal level in 1995. And I was a lonely policy analyst, the only Latina policy analyst in the Department of Education when I started. And by the time I left, there was an additional one in bilingual education. But I was in post-secondary education, focused on, every time I'd hear questions, think, what does this mean for Latinos? And when I was there, HSIs first got funded, and the Department of Education had no idea what institutions would be eligible, how to do outreach, how to get out there. And it started this quest and questioning about Hispanic-serving institutions. What are they? What does it mean to serve students? That continues in the dialogue I have with my colleagues here, and I hope that we can continue to engage in out there. So, what are HSIs? I'll say this, you know, these are institutions, political constructs, are created based, defined by enrollment, not necessarily mission to serve. And that's important for us to think about when we get to what does it mean to serve our Latino students. So in the federal definition, it's 25% or more undergraduate full-time equivalent Hispanic enrollment of degree-granting public or not-for-profit institutions. Big mouthful, right? We have to say 25% Hispanic. But it has implications when you look at the definition. So I just want to make sure we're all talking about the same thing, because the definition is enrollment, and what we care about is so much more than enrollment. But that's what defines these institutions. So why look at Hispanic-serving institutions? Why are we up here? Why are we even having this panel? Now, here's a couple of additional stats complementing what Rudolfo shared. HSIs are in 16 locations, but concentrated in California, Texas, and Puerto Rico, although there are HSIs in Oregon and Kansas and Massachusetts. So, you know, we are really all over. We started with 131 HSIs when I first looked at them in 1995 and did analysis. Today, well, 2009-10, there are 293 institutions, so more than doubled, and that's all predicated on enrollment. About half of HSIs are two-year institutions. And that's important when we think about the legacy and what we're trying to do in serving our students overall. This construct, this definition of Hispanic serving institution was invented in the 1980s with community-based folk who saw, in institutions and otherwise, saw the importance of looking at institutions that had a concentrated mass of Latino students. And in 1990s, they were identified in federal policy. But, you know, back then, federal policy overall, was really focused on access, right? It was getting students in the door. You know, que vayan con Dios, we got you in the door, it's up to you to get through, right? That's kind of the approach we took in policy. Well, I think it's very different, and we're much more sophisticated as we think about what these institutions can be, what they should be, they must be for us. So in 2010 and now, you know, the policy conversation is about completion and student success, right? So how do we translate that when our definition of HSIs is predicated on enrollment and our needs of a community are about success, about completion? That defines, I think, the discourse for all of us here as we think about this effort. So here are a couple of policy assumptions and theories that really helped ground HSIs. And again, it's really for us to think critically about these institutions when we get into the Q&A that I'm trying to foster this perspective. So the idea from a political perspective is that institutions that have a concentrated enrollment of Latino students must be for one of two reasons. Either they're very proactive in serving and investing in Latinos, and they have some educational quality, and that's why Latinos are enrolling there, or critical mass theory, which says an organization that has a concentrated mass of anything, and this started with nuclear physics, by the way, but we kind of translated it into this, critical mass, that an organization has to change. When you reach some kind of critical mass, the organization cannot remain as it was. Those are two theories that lead into the creation of HSIs. Well, I will say to you that in all of our work, we know that that theory and those political assumptions aren't always validated by institutions that meet an enrollment criteria. A Hispanic-serving institution that is enrolling and not serving doesn't meet these criteria. So not surprising to most of you, some institutions are very reluctant to change. They prefer students change to accommodate them rather than changing to accommodate the student. We all know that. And that's a big challenge as we think about what an HSI, what a Hispanic serving institution can be. So let me ask this. How many of you here either were or enrolled at an HSI? Maybe half. Okay, great. And I'm going to ask a rhetorical question, but I think it'll get to where we are. So did you all choose to enroll or to work there because it was an HSI? Did you even know it was an HSI when you first went there? Rhetorical question. I see some heads nodding, you know, hand up, even though it was a rhetorical question. I don't need you to respond. here's something to think about. Latino students create HSIs. Okay? It's not necessarily the other way around. This is what we know. Location, access, and cost informs Latino students' choices. And where they go creates a critical mass of enrollment. It's not necessarily, although that's, I don't want to discredit institutions that are being proactive in reaching out to Latinos, but it's less because of institutional effort, and it's more because of our choices based on location, costs, and access that creates HSIs, okay? So here's the critical question. If students create HSIs, how can we get institutions to serve Latinos better? That has to be what permeates our thinking when we talk about HSIs, right? How do we define accountability? You know, accountability is the word of the day in policy nowadays, right? And I'm a policy wonk. So that students are being served. And how do we make sure that they're responsible for Latino student success? This is all from an institutional perspective, right? So here are some key elements. I've got my one-minute wave. But we have to get beyond enrolling. So it's enrolling, it's retaining, it's supporting, it's educating, engaging, celebrating, embracing, exposing students, and graduating Latino students. That's a Hispanic-serving institution that does all of those things. Then it's creating metrics so we know those institutions are doing those kinds of things, right? And it means more than enrolling. It means what is our faculty representation? And Rodolfo shared some of these. Policy, implications, staff representation, outreach. What are persistent rates? What are our gateway course successes with Latinos? I'll put it this way. What works for Latinos and that should be at HSIs? I'll just tell you the answer, and hopefully we can have a conversation about it. Intentionality matters. Intentionality defines an HSI, okay? So that it's not by default, that we're disaggregating our data so we know we're serving Latinos. And that we're always asking, is whatever we're doing working for Latino students? Because if it works for us, it will work for other students. What I can't assume anymore is that if it works for other students, that it's going to work for Latinos. Because that's what we've had historically, and it hasn't proven to be effective. So you always have to ask, what is it working for us? And if it's so, it will work for others. So, the last points I'll leave you with, what does it mean to serve? You're intentional, you're rigorous, you're self-aware, you're accountable and responsible for Latino student success. You can transform and inform the rest of higher education, whether or not they're an HSI. And you're preparing for that 21st century student that's already here, and that's us. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. I'm Irvan Garcia, New Mexico State University. I want to speak to you about the demarginalization of cultural citizenship and local and indigenous knowledges toward cognitive justice. These views in this presentation also represent several cross-disciplinary faculty with whom we work at New Mexico State. Doctors Cristina Medina, Carlos Posadas, Michelle Valverde, and Marisol Ruiz, particularly in this piece. And this is a brief overview of a larger manuscript that I was able to call and put together for this presentation that gives you a snippet of the things we're working on. The archaeology of success or failure for Latino students in American colleges and universities is constituted between two incompatible languages. One language addresses access and points toward a decent and socially redeeming life. The other language speaks of denial, of basic civil rights and opportunities moving in the direction of a diminished life on the margins. For Latino, Latina students and other marginalized communities, the notion of diverse cultural citizenship adds to the debate. The term cultural citizenship offers an intentional oxymoron because the two provisos are oppositionally juxtaposed. The term culture is robustly rooted in diversity and requires the action of a participatory democracy and a social justice outlook. The term citizenship is embedded in a blend of tensions relating to full or partial residency of a group in a society. In this milieu, Latino cultural citizenship merges into a clash of complexities facing colleges and universities. HSI program funding offers the potential to facilitate HSIs into expanding and enhancing academic offerings, culturally responsive programs and curricula, and institutional stability that in the very least supports Latino, Latina students from the point of entry through graduation. We're all generally aware here that HSIs have had measured success in that significant numbers of Latino, Latina students continue to leave campuses without completing their education. Why? An inviting campus climate with well-prepared mentors and eager role models and strong faculty able to accentuate an education integrated with cultural funds could arguably augment the academic success of Latino, Latina students. So we need to work on that. All learners must be afforded opportunities to study and learn in healthy, dynamic, and safe environments in which a broad range of social and cultural funds are readily displayed and shared. This is good, sound cultural citizenship practice in colleges and universities. A major challenge educational institutions face in the United States is provinciality of knowledges. Cultural knowledges coming from diverse sectors of a society are to a large degree ideologically neutered by grand narratives offered in institutional curricula. Most institutional curricula continue to provide a reproductive undertaking of Western science ways of knowing that offer strict and narrow authorial know-it-all views of the world through officialized versions of knowing. Knowledge is never neutral and is reverentially positioned to serve the majoritarian cultural discourse by representing selected traditions enforced as legitimate truth for engaging and interpreting the world. What we habitually chase regarding knowledge is cemented in Western science. Western science is loaded with a weighty positivist paradigm that appropriates mainstream behavioral and organizational theories. Within this positivist agreement, all natural phenomena can be controlled and predicted. Additionally, the concept of IQ continues to swiftly and ruthlessly move with testing in schools and educational settings, controlling all arguments regarding the achievement gap. The achievement gap occurs as part of an undemocratic design that fails to assess proficiency academically outside of Western epistemological measures. Over the last five decades, an assortment of diverse multicultural discourses that recognize other cultural traditions have made limited headway into school curricula. A central adaptation of a broader form of cognitive justice has been constructivist social science programs and projects, including women, ethnic, and cultural studies that have served to inform the larger society concerning an assortment of cultures other than their own, although added to the curriculum as disembedded structures. Cristina Medina, Carlos Posadas document the conflict between Latino, Latina family needs and academic responsibilities that runs a common thread. They state that these struggles and challenges can be seen repeatedly throughout Latino student populations in higher education. The cultural value of a strong family unit can sometimes be at odds with achieving a college degree. Dr. Marisol Ruiz and Michelle Valverde write about the rift between HSIs and PK-12 systems or public educational systems. Throughout the country, there is disengagement between those entities of public schools, the community, and the university. The current educational system also leads to a long-standing rift between these institutions. At the college and university level, Latino students often encounter indifferent, unfriendly, and contemptuous hostilities on campus that adversely affect their academic performance. What college and university personnel fail to monitor is the consistent complaints by minority students regarding many assaults and microaggressions, that is, hostile social climates on college campuses each year. Many assaults and microaggressions are defined as the body politic of racism commonly found on college and university campuses across the United States. Complicating the tensions of attending and performing well in school are the parameters of achievement that are constantly changing. It's like moving the goalpost when a team is getting ready to score. The injudicious belief that by implementing school improvement accountability schemes through a constricted pathway of proficiency testing might close a gap speaks to blind arrogance positioned by marketplace imperatives that rather than a sincere attempt to acknowledge and promote assorted ways of learning and knowing. Knowledge enrichment occurs when local and indigenous knowledges are affirmed, not when they are submerged into a Western scientific assemblage and denied participation. Vandervelden asserts that rather than pursuing a knowledge-sharing path for broad understanding, teacher-centered policies have coerced the drive to narrow the conception of learning into repressed positions of knowledge management and high test scores based on standardized testing. What is knowledge? Who owns it? And what and whom does it serve? These are basic democratic questions that need critical deliberation for stemming the development of knowledge as a commodity. Knowledge is in danger of becoming an exclusive, predetermined set of goods rather than an intellectual resource for providing a broader glimpse of global diversity. HSIs must take a position to make long-term commitments to push colleges and universities to become transformative, all-inclusive institutions. HSIs have to move beyond Hispanic enrolling and become Hispanic-serving in a proactive sense of the word, or rather provocative sense of the word. It will take institutional commitment in terms of resources across the board, that is financial, personnel, programming, and other. Also, HSIs must make public how they are awarded grants and their responsibility to the Hispanic community and the student body, the faculty, the staff. Colleges and universities are quick to take HSI dollars, but extremely quiet about how they utilize the money to support Hispanic students, faculty, and staff. Thank you.
My name is Erica Romero, and I work with the Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities, and HACU was actually founded in 1986 for the creation of Hispanic-serving institutions. But before I get into that, I can't pass up the opportunity with a room full of students and faculty to mention that part of being Hispanic-serving is making sure that Latino students have success. And in that vein, we just opened our scholarship program. Applications are available online, so please take the opportunity to apply at HACU.net, and our scholarships no longer require a social security number. And also the deadline, the deadline to apply for our paid internship program for the summer is this Friday. So if you haven't taken that time to apply, student success comes when you can afford college and when you get the opportunity to learn on the job. And I'll be happy to talk to students or faculty afterwards about either of our programs. But we were created around the idea of a Hispanic-serving institution. We were founded in San Antonio with 16 colleges who came to the conclusion that historically black colleges had been founded and recognized to serve the African-American community. You had the tribal colleges, which were founded with the purpose of serving the American Indian community. But there wasn't any special recognition that institutions that serve Latinos also had special needs. And Hispanic serving institutions is a political construct. But one of the political constructs that we should think about is that we chose to be called Hispanic serving, not Hispanic enrolling. And what does that mean? We could have gone to Congress and asked, if we enroll more than 25% Latinos, just give us the money. One of the things about Hispanic serving institutions is, first off, unlike the other colleges, our programs are all competitive grants, and so the institutions have to compete amongst themselves for the funding. And the second thing is, we actually have to report to Congress what those institutions are doing with the funding. And I know Deborah talked briefly about accountability, and I do a lot of our state level policy, and one of the things that comes up invariably is, do we do performance-based funding? At one point, there was a discussion about whether or not HSI funding was going that way. And from our perspective, we always caution Congress to be careful what you ask for, because you might just get it. And what I mean by that is, when you looked at what happened with some of the historically black colleges in Ohio that did do performance-based funding, they just decided to continue to bleed money and not stop serving their population, versus our community colleges who just openly became more selective. And so one of the things that you need to look at when you set the parameters for how do we hold institutions accountable, because we definitely want Title V funds to be used for the right purpose. Number one is a recognition that when an institution receives Title V funding, it serves all students, not just Latino students. So for instance, our institutions that use their money to fund a transfer center, because as was mentioned, most of our students start at a two-year institution and go to a four-year. So if you fund your transfer center and you look around and you don't see any Latinos, you didn't use your Title V money properly. Because the point was, you received the money to get your students there. And so there is that accountability where we need to ask our institutions, how are you using the money, and are the students who were supposed to be served, are they the ones being served? And as I mentioned, they do turn in results, but one of the things we need to also ask is, what's our benchmark? Do you benchmark against yourself and the progress you've made since you've received the Title V grant? Do you benchmark against other Hispanic-serving institutions who aren't receiving the Title V funding, and are your students outperforming them? Or the one that worries us the most is, do you base it on how Latino students are doing in general? And I am a Berkeley grad, I love my alma mater, but I can tell you that a Berkeley Latino is in fact different from somebody who had to start at a different type of institution. And so the worry becomes, are we giving a fair comparison? And at the same time saying, yes, perhaps our students came with additional challenges. This is why you are receiving the additional money. Use that money appropriately to get your students not only in the door, but out the door. And so one of the things that comes with being Hispanic serving and that we're gonna do tomorrow, HACU has a Walmart grant that we are using. It's the responsibility of sharing what works. And the HACU Walmart grant is actually going to take a look at institutions that are having success with their students, their Latino students, and getting them both in and out the door, and seeing if it's replicable at other institutions. And taking that knowledge and sharing it freely so that we know what works and what can be replicated. And that is something that grants always help, because as many of us know, in these budget times, there is no money. But that is something that we can do among our institutions, is talk to each other. What are you doing on each other's campuses that has been working? And can it be replicated on a different campus? And so our institutions most definitely have to be held accountable. I always think there should be a robust discussion about how we hold them accountable. But our students should be getting both in and out the door with those Title V funding. Thank you.
Yes, you did.
Before we open it up to the audience for questions, we wanted to give the panel an opportunity, given the range of what they shared, and honestly, I wish we had given them a full half hour, whole segment, frankly, to speak. I think there was a very concentrated amount of detail there that they shared. But I'd like to give them an opportunity amongst themselves initially just to raise some issues that they want to raise with them, and then we'll open it up to the audience for questions as well. If any of the panelists have any observations or questions about what you heard from each other initially. Content areas.
Thinking.
Okay.
Well, no, I think there are a lot of issues involved when you're trying to think critically about these institutions, what they can be, because they weren't originally designed to serve our population per se. Trying to transform an institution to serve its students is a perpetual challenge. And whether we're talking about it from a cultural competency and transformation, or we're talking about it from a political environment and a context of informing and supporting financially and holding accountable, I think this is a new enough kind of research area that we're trying to figure out the framing and the construct to make it meaningful for all of you, but more importantly, for what we care about, and that's students. And it's not just getting them out the door, it's about graduating them with that sheepskin, with that diploma. And that's got to be what undergirds our work instead of just enrollment. And I think the ways that we can do that and find what's working is what we need to be sharing with all of you and being shared with us, as we have a platform to talk about it that can be useful.
An interesting perspective for me that I heard was sort of a shifting of it is the students who make the Hispanic Serving Institution, and I think that's a different take. I mean, oftentimes working at an institution, we're obviously thinking about the students, but the fact that in this case the students make the Hispanic Serving Institution, and what does that mean then, you know, from that vantage point, from that perspective? And I think that's an interesting sort of shifting of just where we come from or where we start from in terms of our thinking sometimes. Mm-hmm. As well. Any other thoughts from the panelists for each other?
I think it's important that when we think of Hispanic serving institutions and we think of the professors who are at Hispanic serving institutions, that they en masse need to rethink how they look at teaching and learning, and to make sure that in fact they are dismantling, questioning, weakening, undermining, and diluting the systematic forces that obstruct and forbid the success of marginalized and disenfranchised and othered students. It's not just a matter of teaching to those that they have always been comfortable with, but rethinking how teaching and learning is going to occur when working with Latinas and Latino students, with poor white students, with any marginalized students. And it's not just one professor or two professors. As I remember in an early book, 36 Children, when one child told the teacher, "One good teacher ain't good enough." So it seems to me that we have to have a cadre of professors consistently across whatever discipline to make sure that, in fact, they're being proactive and looking at all the cultural wealth that students bring.
Thank you.
I'll say that.
I'm going to go ahead and open it up for questions at this point, if that's okay. Let's go ahead and invite the students or faculty or staff. Community leaders, please.
Buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Librada Murillo. Soy presidente de la Asociación de Padres de Moreno Valley. Y mi pregunta es para la señora Débora Santiago sobre la ética y equidad que se debe de implementar en las universidades y los colegios sobre el monitoreo de admisión para nuestros niños latinos. ¿Y cuál es la ética y equidad que utilizan las universidades para involucrarnos a nosotros como padres de esos estudiantes que ustedes van a tener en esas universidades? Porque somos los últimos en enterarnos cuáles son los fondos que nos apoyarían a nuestros hijos. Y para el señor que se atrevió a hablar sobre la burocracia que hay en las universidades para admitir y la segregación y el racismo para que nuestros maestros latinos puedan llegar a tener un TEN senior, y por qué hay tantos procesos para que ellos puedan llegar a tener su señoría.
Gracias, gracias por las preguntas. So there's two questions that were posed here, one for Deborah and then one for Dr. Herman.
Sí. Voy a empezar. Mil gracias por su pregunta. De a ver si lo cojo correctamente, y si no, usted me corrige. Pero involucrar a los padres en la educación de sus hijos al nivel universitario no es parte de la cultura de la universidad, y lamentablemente lo diría, pero siempre ha sido en loco parentis, lo que hablábamos en plazo del padre cuando iban a la universidad desde hasta las tantas. Hoy día tiene que ser diferente. Lo difícil es en esas instituciones asegurarnos que los cambios que son necesarios para involucrar no solo los padres, pero la familia en sí, ¿verdad? Que tengamos en mente los recursos, las habilidades, las relaciones con la comunidad para poder involucrar la familia completa. Es difícil para una institución que no trabaja con y por la comunidad tener estructuras para asegurarnos que ellos sean parte de la educación de sus hijos. Hay cosas bien fáciles que podríamos hacer. Y los hemos visto en las instituciones que realmente le tienen ojo a la familia y los logros de sus hijos. Cosas bien fáciles como mandar una carta a la familia, a los padres directamente, en inglés en un lado, español en el otro, sobre el progreso de su hijo, lo que está estudiando y las necesidades. Se podría hacer. Hay programas como Upward Bound, hay unos que lo hacen. Y el padre en sí sabe lo que está haciendo el hijo y le puede ayudar, pero también él sabe lo que está pasando. Así que hay muchos ejemplos, diría, lo difícil es que las instituciones no han pensado en eso, esa conexión de la manera que podrían. Y bueno, es algo que tenemos que empujar y enseñar ejemplos de donde trabaja. La segunda parte de la pregunta son los fondos disponibles. ¿Y por qué no le informan a los padres más de los fondos disponibles para pagar la educación de su hijo? ¿Verdad? Correcto. Bueno, otra pregunta complicada, pero no tan complicada. ¿Sería fácil si teníamos ya en mente que teníamos que involucrar a los padres, darle la información sobre fondos disponibles? Las instituciones piensan que los estudiantes y los padres tienen que encontrar la información sí misma y que hay, el gobierno federal, hay otros que tienen que hacerlo. Ahora, hay instituciones que saben, que tienen talleres para padres y comunidades con información sobre el FAFSA y hay fondos disponibles. Pero realmente le ponen la responsabilidad a la familia y no lo hacen ellos mismos de la manera que podrían. Tienen oficinas de ayuda financiera, pero tienen a 3, 4, 5 personas y esos pobres hacen mucho, pero con la cantidad de estudiantes se hace difícil. Así que encontrar manera, hacerlo una prioridad para la institución, involucrar a padres y darle información de fondos disponibles, tiene que alcanzar un meta y un nivel que no está hoy día. Nosotros aquí en el panel, ustedes, tenemos que empujar, tenemos que requerir que nos den esa información que nos incluyen. Y eso depende de nosotros, porque desafortunadamente no va a ser en la institución si nosotros no le preguntamos y le forzamos a hacerlo.
Gracias. Sí, su pregunta sobre su pregunta sobre la permanencia de la facultad en las universidades es una cuestión muy importante. Una de las cosas que nos sucede cuando llegamos a la universidad es que no solo tenemos el trabajo de ser profesores, hacer investigación, escribir y trabajar como profesores, sino también trabajar con los estudiantes latinos que nos llegan a las oficinas con retos de problemas que anuncié, por ejemplo, que un profesor, una profesora no los está tratando igual o con respeto y les molesta que los profesores les faltan respeto a los estudiantes latinos. Y entonces ya se involucra el profesor afuera de su trabajo de profesor y empieza a trabajar con los estudiantes como consejero, como padre, como amigo, y apoyar y ir a las organizaciones de los estudiantes arriba y además de lo que debe ser. Entonces, pierde tiempo el profesor, la profesora latino, latina, que tiene que escribir sus artículos, sus libros, hacer su trabajo de enseñanza para que reciba buenas evaluaciones. Toda esa cuestión que es triple o más el trabajo que tiene que hacer un profesor latino o latina en la universidad y ese es el problema más grande que tenemos. Y por eso no sé, por ejemplo, en la Universidad Estatal de Nuevo México tenemos casi el 50% de estudiantes latinos en la universidad en general, pero solamente 5% de la facultad son latinos y latinas.
Gracias por las preguntas. So again, please introduce yourself and then you state your question. Good afternoon. My name is Lourdes Maldonado. I'm a student affairs professional at the University of California, Riverside. I'm also a doctoral student at the University of Southern California. And my question is referring to graduate education in terms of Latino students. So I wanted to know, in your professional judgment, how important is that topic? Why is it not being addressed as widely as other issues are? And what in your respective areas is being done to develop and promote graduate education, especially doctoral attainment among our Latino students, especially since our percentages is anywhere between 1 and 4% of Latinos that ever obtain the highest degree possible. Thank you.
If you don't mind, I'll start, but I'll try to be quick. You know, if from a policy perspective, our focus has really been historically on K-12. Dropouts, English language learners, high school graduation. And by efforts by others, by organizations to try and say, you know, we have to address those issues, but some of us, despite that, are getting through and going to college. We have to address Latinos in higher education as well. That's a more recent dialogue in the policy environment. And so we're behind the curve. I think we've tried to address graduate education. There is a program at graduate education, HSIs. There isn't the policy push in graduate education right now. It's seen as a drainer financially, and we should just be grateful to get them through. And that's a crass way of saying it, but moving the dialogue from just Latinos in K-12 to Latinos in higher ed, not just accessing and completing, has taken all the force we have up to this point. Graduate ed has to be a priority. It's not, and I think that's a policy mistake on our part.
And I can tell you from Haku's perspective, we actually advocated a few years ago for the creation of Title V Part B, which actually funds graduate institutions, because when you look at the professoriate and don't even look at the presidency, it doesn't reflect our students. And so there is actually funding now for Hispanic-serving institutions that have graduate school programs to do outreach to Latino students to get them through. I always tell the story that when I went through my master's degree, I figured I was done because I never wanted to do another statistics course in my life. And somebody looked at me and said, well, you know, you can pay somebody to do your stats for your PhD. And I looked at them dumbfounded, and I went through Berkeley and Harvard, and nobody had ever told me this. And so when you go through great institutions, you know, people mm-hmm. assume that you know the process through getting through higher education. And the answer is, if nobody in your family has ever done it, no matter where you went to school, there's a good chance you don't know it. And that's why you've got the Title V Part B, but quite frankly, it's a very small part of funding. And I think that institutions need to do a better job of looking at students who are already at their institutions and making sure that they know the process of getting all the way through a terminal degree.
Just also a quick commercial. The Graduate Forum for Diversity in Graduate Education, they just closed registration yesterday. This year it's going to be at San Diego State University on April 14th. They invite all the Southern California region to go for their sophomores, juniors, seniors, master's students to go and look at grad school opportunities. There's about 150 programs from across the country that'll descend upon the campus. There's about 2,000 historically underrepresented students that will be there also. Unfortunately, they did close registration, but you didn't hear this from me, but you might do walk-ins, I don't know. Check with them. But this is one of the opportunities, very few opportunities that I'm aware of in terms of encouraging historically underrepresented students to go to grad school. It's an incredible time saver, money saver. Take the opportunity, if not this year, next year, to look at that. Let me actually go, I'm going to go online first before we come back to you, if I may.
Yes, this question comes from the Washington State University watching right now. The question is twofold, but the question is, how does the conversation of intentionality, such as stated, are we serving Latino students, not the other way around, translate to such non-HSI campuses, more specifically, like Tucson's MAS program? That really they want to ask the views on the current context of the HB 2281 and Tucson Unified School District choosing to articulate how teaching and learning can be illegal. What are your views?
Sounds like a complex question there, but any taker on that one?
It's a policy question, and I'm actually the person at Haku who took the position in opposition to HB 2281, so I'll take a stab at that. First off, Arizona is its own state. It is definitely very different from a lot of this nation. But when you look at what we mean by intentionality, for starters, the state of California actually passed a resolution saying we value ethnic studies and will continue to fund it. And so the state as a whole has made that choice here in California, and other states can look at something similar. But you really need to think about, you know, Deborah made the distinction between Hispanic enrolling and Hispanic serving, and the truth is it's a huge distinction. I have seen institutions that have literally created special programs where they go into the community and they reach out to their community colleges and they specifically look at their Latino student population. They go into areas that are predominantly Latino and they try to recruit those students onto their campus. They are intentionally trying to serve that population. And then when the student is on campus, you know, getting them in the door is great, but do you then have programs to make sure that they get out the door and that they have that sense of community, that they feel like they actually belong on the campus? Some of that, you know, when legislatures pass bills that make you feel like you're not welcome in their state, let alone on their campus, it's most definitely a challenge. But I think institutions can also take a role in making sure that that student feels welcome and they're valued.
Thank you. I'm going to take one more question, and we've actually been asked to run out of time, but we've run out of time, unfortunately.
Well, I want to say thank you for listening and taking the question. I can relate to every single thing you're saying. I wish I could put you in my pocket and take you home and give me some more further information. But being a student, as you described in many different ways, and also being an educator, seeing the cycle repeat itself again, you said it very well, Deborah, that there is policy in place, but again, the accountability factor is not there. What is the list or some suggestions that you can give to me to start holding institutions accountable and the strings that are attached to that funding? And how do we get the transparency to really take place? Because of course, everything's in the hush-hush behind closed doors because everybody's made the best practice or the decision to service the community when we're seeing all these fallouts of more students and students that are ending up like myself that are not getting that full support. And we're still gonna do it regardless because it's almost like a social expectation. But what are those suggestions that we can start taking, and where's the space that we can go, like a site, you know, for all those techies that are here today, that space and that site to start reporting on these things and to get the support we need.
Yes.
Because it's not easy.
Amen. So, tools for accountability. Require your institution to disaggregate their data. You have to know, it has to start with data. If you bring it from the heart and that's the only reason you raise it and the only way you raise it, you're not going to be taken seriously. Have them disaggregate the data for enrollment. Have them disaggregate the data for completion. Have them disaggregate the data for persistence rates. Those are data they already collect. And they should be able to disaggregate it by race and ethnicity. So you know if Latino students are doing as well as or better than other students or if there are needs to address. That's the first part of accountability. You have to know because otherwise you can be in denial. There's this great phrase, everybody says, we want to educate all students. Well, you're not educating all students if there are achievement gaps. And you have to own up to that. The only way you know that is by looking at the data, all right? And now then you can't be in denial because if the data's on your side, it's a different policy conversation, right? So that's a big one. Take a look at gateway courses. Push. We know in other analysis we've done, the gateway courses, the math, the reading, the ones, remediation, are your Latino and African American students getting out? Are they completing your gateway courses? If not, and that's data, but that will tell you a great deal about the investment, the commitment of the institution, or not, and getting your students through. Those are two. A more traditional policy one that I have some challenges with, but it's available because they collect it, is graduation rates. There are lots of challenges with it, but I will tell you this. In policy environments, that's the magic number for lots of your politicians to demonize an institution or hold it up as effective. Ask them to disaggregate that by race, ethnicity. And I can assure you, as bad as the rates are, they're worse when you look at your specific ethnic groups. Use data to hold them accountable as a way to start. When it comes to grants and funding, ask them what they've done with the data, with the funding, excuse me. Ask them to report out what you said you were going to do with it, and did you do it? Any student, any person has the right to ask that. And if you're challenged or feel insecure, ask Excelencia, ask Haku to be there right next to you, because we can beg the question. And we will beg the question. As external agents, it doesn't put you in the line of fire, but it's us who are holding externally accountable an institution like yours.
Okay, that's good. Thank you so much to the panel. Before we end here, Daniel, you had just something real quick to say, because our next speaker is ready to go.
Don't want to hold him up. To inform and to organize are absolutely critical in terms of the question that you raised, and I think that you all have brought an enormous amount of information, and I think fodder for us to continue to think about and process. So I want to thank the panel for your initial really sort of entry into this conversation, because I think we could have stayed here a lot longer here. And I think just to say that organizing around these issues, to Enrique and what you've done, is also a part of what needs to happen. So I thank you also.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.